Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. How are you all doing? I am so glad that you're all here. And that was Grace by the amazingly talented and unbelievable singer Julie Kinchuk Gibbons. She will be on later on tonight, and you're going to be in for a treat with her. I am so excited that you all could join me. I am just happy that you're here and that we are back with another great day. I have to apologize for those of you in the chat room. The chat room has been a little glitchy today. I don't know if it's because of the weather or have no idea what's going on. So I can see everybody that's in the chat room, but I don't know if you guys can. So hopefully we'll be able to sort it out before the end of the show. And I am just so extremely happy that you're all here. To let you know, today our guest is going to be the amazing Darlene Loof. Now, Darlene, she's going to be coming on in a few minutes, and I will tell you a little bit more about her. But her story is just awe-inspiring. I mean, this woman has gone through so much and continues to do so with a smile on her face and a positive attitude. And no matter what curveballs life had thrown at her, she was more concerned with helping others, and she continues to be that way. So I'm going to fill you in a little bit more on that when we get Darlene. She's going to be calling in a few minutes. And as I said, we're going to have Julie Kinchuk. She was on the show a couple of years back when she had just released a new CD, and she has a few more songs that she's going to share with us, and I'm really excited about it because this is a really amazing, talented woman, and it's one of those that you ask yourself, why is she not signed? But anyway, she's going to be here, and it's a great treat for us. Also, we are going to have the phenomenal director, actor Tim Ryan. For our listeners that were with us a couple of weeks back, we had Adam Dawes, and Adam Dawes was the actor in the short film Date Night. Well, Tim Ryan is the creative mind behind it. So I thought it would be a cool idea to kind of get the backdrop behind how the story was created, how the character was created, and the whole crazy process. So we're going to have him on as well. And he has a couple of other things that he's going to share with us. Updates. Guys, remember, if you have any announcements, we are on a national, international level, so you're more than welcome to email me any announcements that you have coming up, especially if you are a nonprofit, a school organization, or just someone that's throwing something to help someone out, you are more than welcome to send them to us. We will definitely announce them on air with all the details. You can email those to Ordinary Woman. The spelling is WMN, Ordinary WMN at gmail.com. Just please make sure you put in the subject line what the event is and the date, so that way we can get to it in enough time that we will be able to make the announcements. Also, if you guys, as you know, we founded the Sarah Joy Foundation last year, and on September 15th, we are starting the first road race. I apologize if I sound a little distracted. I'm trying to fix the chat room while I'm talking to you guys. So September 15th of this year, we will be doing our inaugural road race. It's going to be a 5K road race, and it's going to be also a walk, so you can do either or. And you can also do it in teams or as an individual. So that is going to be held in Media, Pennsylvania at Ridley Creek State Park. You can go on our website, www.sarahsjoyfoundation.org, for more information. That's sarahsjoyfoundation.org for more information. And I know you guys are spread all over the country, and obviously some of you cannot make the trip. But please, 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 if you will consider making a donation, if you go to our website that I just mentioned, sarahsjoyfoundation.org. We're doing a virtual runner/walker program. So if you donate $25, which are tax deductible because we are a 503C and it is a tax deductible donation, what we're doing is anybody that makes a donation of $25 is being signed up as a virtual runner or walker, and you are going to be in a drawing for some fabulous prizes, gift certificates, that kind of thing, and it's all going to a good cause. Our foundation was started, for those of you that don't know, because we do have a lot of new people. Sarah Joy Irohito was my daughter-in-law. She passed away March of 2012 from breast cancer and its complications. She fought it very valiantly for 2.5 years. She left behind my son, her husband, and 2 young boys who were 3 and 1. And one of the things that Sarah made a commitment of her last year of her life was that she decided that she wanted to make as many memories as possible with her husband and her two children and us as a family. For those of you that have had family touched by cancer or have had loved ones or even lost people, you know how it becomes. When you are going through the treatments, your life becomes that hospital room, that hospital, the treatments, everything, and everything kind of falls by the wayside. And sadly, you have to think about the fact that for some people, like in the case with Sarah, those were going to be the last months or years of their life. And the memories that the family are going to have of their loved ones is being in a hospital room, going through the treatments, the illness, and all of that. So one of the things that Sarah decided to do was to go and try to do as many day trips or vacations as possible the last year of her life. We went to Maryland. We went to Ocean City. She actually went parasailing. And for those of you that don't know my son, he is terribly frightened of heights. I mean, if he goes up on a ladder, by the time he gets to the third rung, he's going noodle in the knees. And she got him to go parasailing with her. They went jet skiing. They went camping. They did a lot of things that they basically tried to make as many memories as possible in a very short time. So the reason I'm telling you guys this story is for you to get a backdrop of the foundation. Well, one of the things that happens is when your loved one passes away, you as the spouse or the family members are now responsible for all of their bills, all of their responsibilities, whatever wasn't paid. The companies are going to come after you. So my son just buried his wife. He's dealing with all of that. Well, on top of that, now he's dealing with his phone getting blown up from collectors wanting to get money from him for his wife's debts. And it wasn't a case of, okay, let's work it out, you know, let's talk to you. No, it was kind of like, well, she died. Oh, good. Now you're responsible. So within a matter of 3 weeks, all of her debts were automatically switched over to my son. A lot of times they didn't even bother calling him or trying to make arrangements plan. It was just there. So now my son is dealing with that, the emotional loss of his wife, his best friend, the mother of his children, and all these bills as well. So one of the reasons why we started the Sarah Joy Foundation is that we wanted to be able to give grants to families to help them out. I mean, yes, there are a lot of amazing foundations out there, but sadly, they don't cover a lot of this stuff. They don't. You can't go to, I'm not mentioning any names, but you can't go to a major, the biggest foundation that's out there for cancer and say, oh, well, I have a $5,000 bill that I need paid because my mom passed away and I'm responsible for it. But then that's not what they do. What they do is they do research, and basically that's where the bulk of their money goes. So as far as you being able to go somewhere and say, I need assistance, that's not there. Your insurance company pays a certain amount, the rest you're stuck with, and then there's the additional cost, whatever's left behind. Case in point, my daughter-in-law's school loans. My son got stuck with that. Thank God that his father-in-law helped him out and said, I will pay for that. So these are all the things that we started thinking about. So we decided to start the Sarah Joy Foundation. And on September 11th, 2012, we got incorporated in the state of Philadelphia, and that obviously works nationwide and internationally. So our goal is to be able to give grants to families that have one a loved one going through the illness, and to be able to have them go away and be able to create a memory with them, even if it's to go away for a weekend or to just get away from the hospital, from the hospital rooms, and just feel normal. Because that's one of the things the women that I've talked to, and even the men that go through cancer, is the fact that once that diagnosis comes, one of the things they say is, I never felt normal again. There was the stigma of people looking at me. Either they were looking at me with pity or feeling sorry or awkward. Or one of the people that I talked to said, my friends suddenly really weren't calling as much because they didn't know what to say. And that's one of the things that is very awkward for people, because they're like, well, what do I say? Do I keep reminding them that they have cancer? No. How about you call me and talk to me about the latest show you just watched? Or let's gossip about Breaking Bad or Dexter or any of that. Just take my mind out of it. So since we started in September of last year, going on a year now, we have given over $3,000 in grants out to people that needed assistance. And I have to remind you, we are very small. There's basically four of us that are the board, and everything has been word of mouth, because what we have tried to do is every fundraiser that we've had, we've tried to have every penny go back into being able to accumulate enough to give out grants. And on that note, I have to give extreme thanks to Jeffrey and Amy Lake. On August 10th, there was a Spartan race in Massachusetts. And for some of you that aren't familiar with it, these races are intense. It's like an eight-mile run with all these obstacles and stuff. So Jeff and Amy, what they did is he does this every year anyway. So he incorporated a fundraising component to it. So we got a team together. Everybody donated certain money. He got donors and all that. So we did this race with sponsors. And at the end of the race, Jeff presented the foundation with a check of $1,700. And, you know, that is like a spit in the bucket to some organizations, but to us it is huge, because we're so excited to know that we're that much closer to being able to give out another $2,000 or $3,000 grant to someone that might need it, especially with the holidays coming around the corner. So that's one of the reasons that, guys, look, I know you might not be near us, but if you can spare the $25, please do so. Dollars, nickels, whatever. Just go to our website, www.sarahsjoyfoundation.org. When you come to the flash intro, if you click on that, it's going to take you right to the page with all the information for the road race. If you can't make it, any donation, please. Anything we can get, we will greatly appreciate it. If it's $1, $5, $10, whatever, you can make a donation through a PayPal account. And as I said, it's tax deductible. We are a 503C, and we do have a tax-exempt number. So every penny that you donate is tax-deductible. And for everybody that makes a donation, you'll be submitted into the drawings and that kind of thing. Also, if you happen to know of anybody that has a small business or a business in general and would like to make a donation or even sponsor parts of the race, please let us know. We're always looking for sponsors, because we are actually, you know, there is the cost incurred with the road race. Obviously, we have to pay for the management team and T-shirts and medals and all that kind of stuff. So, and we know that the first time out of the gate when you're doing something like this, it's getting the word out, and that's what we're doing. And again, remember, we're not spending money to put ads in the paper or in the radio or on the internet, because that's, we feel, is money that goes better served to help a family out. We're going to have Darlene pretty soon. The other thing I want to remind you guys of, last year, oh my goodness, this is the most amazing thing. My grandchildren were going to have Christmas anyway. We're blessed that we have a huge family and everybody pitched in and everything to help out. But the thing that made their Christmas, and I'm getting a little emotional here, so you're going to have to bear with me. The thing that got us the most was that someone recommended my grandbabies to Toys for Tots. And one of the things that really got me was the fact that these amazing Marines, these two gentlemen, came to our house fully dressed in their dress uniform, the Marines Class A uniform. And the look on my grandchildren's face was like unbelievable. Now, the reason I get emotional is because of the fact that 4 years I have volunteered with Toys for Tots. I've gone to the distribution center, donated toys, whatever. You never think about the fact of what this is doing for the family that's receiving it. I'm not going to lie. One Christmas Eve, my sons and I, there was like three of us. As you, some of you know, I have a bazillion kids. We have 9 kids. So there was four of my boys and I were volunteering at a distribution center on Christmas Eve. So there were families coming in to pick up toys for their children that were otherwise not going to have Christmas. So for us to know what it felt like to actually be like Santa Claus giving out toys on Christmas Eve, seeing the look on these parents' faces. I remember one particular mom, the relief on her face when she left there with a couple of toys for her 5-year-old were beyond anything I could describe. So to flip it years down the road and know what it was like to actually receive the help. And as I said, I want you to understand, for us, it wasn't the gift itself. It was the amazing gesture of having these two men take time out of their life, which I know they're busy because they have lives, they have work, and on top of that, they're serving our country, to come to our house and spend time with my grandchildren and give them this gift. It was the most amazing thing for me that I can't even describe. And to this day, my grandchildren swear that it's not Santa Claus that brings the toys, it's the Marines. So for you Marine guys out there, ooh-ha, that's what they think. The Marines rock. They're better than anything else because the Marines bring the toys. So this year, as part of some of the things that we want to do with the Sarah Joy Foundation, is we're going to have a Toys for Tots drive. And one of the things that I learned when I was working at the distribution center as a volunteer is that everybody donates for the younger kids, you know, the 9 and under. The older kids, not so much. So what winds up happening is, you know, you have a parent that has a 5-year-old or a 9-year-old, and they might have a 12 or a 13-year-old. Yeah, I understand. They're older. They obviously understand certain things more than the 9 or the 5-year-old. But still, it's pretty heartbreaking for a parent that is desperately in need of something for Christmas to not be able to have something for that child. And even though that child is older and they might understand. So this year we decided that on top of, yes, donating, you know, looking for donations of toys for younger kids, we wanted to do a toy drive for the older kids, you know, things that the older kids might use, like blow dryers and, you know, remote control cars like the bigger ones or that kind of thing. So that's another thing that we're going to be doing. So, again, if you feel generous, you're more than welcome to donate on our website. Or if we're going to be doing a toy drive in Pennsylvania and we're going to do a toy drive in Massachusetts as well. Also, I do not work for Walmart. I do not endorse it in any way. But if you do feel like donating a toy, you can always go to your local Walmart, buy it there, and we can pick it up here or in Massachusetts, because that Darlene Wolf, when she comes on, she's going to be our head person in Mass with the Toys for Tots Drive. So if that's something that you're interested in, please email us, ordinarywoman@gmail.com, and I can get you guys more information. Thank you so much for listening to me, because I felt this was very important. Now we're moving on. Darlene is on the line. I want to bring her on, and I cannot wait to have you guys hear this woman's story. Darlene, are you there, sweetheart?
Hi, sunshine. How are you?
Hey, girl. Good. It's so good to hear your voice. I'm so glad
I'm very
to be on
excited.
The show.
Well, thank you
so,
for having
Darlene,
me.
Oh, my gosh. I couldn't think of anybody else to have. And real quick before I get into the guest, I just want to give a little shout-out to everybody that's in the chat room. I think it's finally working. We have Bill435, Dee Dee, welcome back, guest 18873, guest 9973. We have Henry, we have Robert, Wendy, Louie, Tyreen. Thank you so much, guys, for showing up and being there, and I'm so glad that you're here. Darlene, I have to ask you, and we want to get right to it. I need to hear your story. So our listeners want to know, and let me just give you a little backdrop. Darlene and I met, in parentheses, on Facebook, amazing networking tool. So, Darlene, can you tell us a little bit about how I wind up getting in contact with you and what was going on in your life at that time?
Absolutely. Thank you for allowing me to share it. I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer in 2011. And as I was diagnosed, I shared my journey on Facebook because it helped me heal. And in doing so, a lot of people that were not my Facebook friends were reading my posts, you being one of them, saying that I was an encouragement to them, and I always posted positive things. And as a result, you contacted me to friend book you on Facebook, and I have no problem with the gift of gab. I love meeting new people. And so I said, absolutely, and I friended you. And it was then that I learned about Sarah. Now, I'd like the viewers to understand that at this point, I never met Sarah, and I never met Charlie Alejandro. I still can't say your name right. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I've never met Charlie, and I never met Sarah. Only but through Facebook, in sharing my positive journey, did we know one another. And I never had the opportunity to meet Sarah. When Sarah passed, you had contacted me and told me that you were having a dinner in honor of Sarah. Now, me being the person I am, you were my friend at the time, followed me, knew that I sang, knew about my post, knew about my cancer, and asked me to join and asked me to sing. Well, me being the person I am, I was very excited. I'm thinking, awesome, I get to meet a Facebook friend for the first time. I get to sing, which I love to do, and I get to be a part of something that's very near and dear to me. Well, It was so much more than that, and I will forever be grateful for you and your family and Sarah and the Sarah Joy Foundation.
Darlene, before we get into that, I just want our listeners to get a little bit of a feel for you. Because I know when some people get diagnosed is that, like with Sarah, it was more of, okay, initially you're crying, obviously, because it's horrific news, especially when you feel like you have your whole life ahead of you. And then people react in a certain way. After you got diagnosed, what was your reaction and what was your thinking? What was going through your head at that particular time?
When I was first diagnosed, I think when I was very first diagnosed and told when it first came out of the doctor's mouth, I think I had the feeling that most people do when they're told, what did you just say? And then reality sets in. So the first feeling that I had was, oh, my God. But then when I had so much love and so much support around me, but I also love life, and it's mine. So I started to get the attitude, this is my life. I had cancer. It didn't have me. And I kept going with that attitude. And with all the support of my loved ones and my friends, it kept me going. I was not going to give in. And it was a hard fight. But I'm very happy to say that in June, this past June I was in remission for 1 year, and I plan to stay that way.
Oh my gosh, that was like the best news I've heard in forever. That you were, you know, when you told us that you were in remission. Darlene, I have to ask you, because you seem like such an amazingly strong woman, and I know you're not, and that actually is a compliment to you because of the fact that. I think the reason you're such an incredible mentor and people just gravitate to you is because you don't have that perfectionism like, oh, look at me, I'm perfect kind of thing. You have no problem showing the cracks and the divots and the things that you've accumulated over the years in life. Where
Absolutely
do you think
not.
You get that from?
Where do I get it from? I'm not really sure. When I was a little girl, I think it comes from, this is going to sound silly, but I'm a twin, and I was born with a birthmark that is shaped like a pair of lips. And my grandmother used to always say to me, Mother Mary kissed you. And that always stayed with me. And always stayed with me. So I think a little bit of it might have come from that. And the fact that my life experiences, because I'm grateful for what I have, and cancer only magnified that even more. I've always been a positive person my whole life. But cancer magnified the positive being in me even more. I'm just very grateful. Even when I had cancer, I always said, I may have cancer, but there's someone who has it a lot worse than I do. I have a roof over my head. I have food in my belly and people to love me. What's to be sad about? That's the way I look at life. And I love helping people.
Well, you know, that's very evident that you do. And it's funny because one of the things that, and, you know, this is where we continue how we met, for our listeners, when we started the foundation, one of the things is, for those of you that know, I got into doing pageants back in 2011 as kind of like a bet that I had to my daughter and I. We have this thing going on. So anyway, I did this pageant, and I got to learn about how pageantry is such a valuable tool to further your platform. meaning that if you have a foundation or something that you are passionate about, be honest. How many times have you hit up your friend and say, hey, Joe, I need $5 for a raffle for such and such? And they're like, yeah, all right, I'll give me Friday, whatever. But all of a sudden, one of the things I notice, if it's Mrs. Petite America or Miss Nation USA that's suddenly saying, hey, can you help us out? People are just, I don't know why. It's the same person, but they're just more willing to help out. Like, there's more credibility behind it. So that's one of the reasons that we decided that, because I really loved the whole ideal of pageantry. And I know people have these negative connotations about it, and it couldn't be further from the truth, and you can cover that a little bit in a bit. But the thing is that the part that I loved the most was how giving and how much volunteer hours these women would put into it. So we decided that we wanted to have an ambassador for the Sarah Joy Foundation that would basically be the face and voice of the mission statement. And after we talked about it, we decided that you would just be perfect for it. And for our listeners, it was so funny because when I called Arlene, she's so funny because she covered it. She said, oh, well, yeah, I can go to this, you know, party and it's going to be a good time and meet a Facebook friend and I get to sing. Well, I did ask her, I did ask you, right, Darlene? I said, do you like surprises?
Yes, you did. Oh, yes, you did.
And
Darlene,
I said,
I love surprises.
And, yeah, she's like, I love surprises. I'm like, okay, be careful what you ask for. Yeah, so we kind of sprung it on her. You know, we had put this package together, and we had some amazing sponsors, Surefire Studios, and, you know, a lot of other sponsors that came to say, yeah, you know what, this is definitely the person that the foundation needs and wants. So we crowned her that night at our fundraiser, and we were just so happy that you were there. So, Darlene, tell us a little bit what being picked as the ambassador to the Sarah Joy Foundation means, and what do you hope to accomplish with it?
First of all, being chosen to represent such an amazing young woman, I almost feel as if I'm working down here fulfilling what Sarah wasn't able to accomplish here, and
mm-hmm.
she's working up there with me, and we're working together. I almost feel
Absolutely.
As if we have the same type of soul. So to be crowned the Sarah Joy Ambassador, there are no words that I could explain or express. It's such an honor for me. And I'm getting emotional. It's such an honor for me. I never met Sarah, but meeting her family and learning more about her, she's an amazing soul. And it's an honor to represent and carry on what she would have done. And the Sarah Joy Foundation is set up, and my hopes is to be able to help those who are going through such an awful fight. It's a really tough fight. And the love and the support of family and friends is very important. But to be able to give someone back their self-confidence and to be able to possibly give them a weekend of laughter, a weekend of memories, maybe to do something that they never dreamed they would do and make that happen for them is an amazing feeling. And that is my hope through the Sarah Joy Foundation, and to keep her name going and to be able to continue to help those in need who are fighting such a terrible disease.
Now, Darlene, I want to ask you a question, and I know it's a tough question for you. And I know that we, as the family members, we feel so helpless and hopeless at times with the illness and trying to help and whatever. And I know because we, as a human mankind, are always trying to figure out how to do something. So we come up with pink balloons and ribbons and fundraisers and all this. But can you... And this is something that I think is very important for our listeners and for women in general to understand, and even men. Men need to understand this because we always hear breast cancer, and we think of women. Men get breast cancer too. And usually when they do get it, the survival rates for them are not as hopeful as for women. So this is an equal opportunity illness. It doesn't discriminate whether you're a guy or you're a woman. And so, Darlene, you go through all this. You go through the chemo. You go through the radiation. You go through all the ups and downs. Now you get to the point that you are in remission. Can you tell us a little bit about what are some of the emotional roller coasters that you go through and what are some of the challenges that you face now that you are in remission and moving forward?
What most people don't realize when a person is diagnosed with cancer and they've gone through the treatments and they've lost their hair and that all that part of it is done, and they think that if a person is in remission, that's it, they're done. That is so far from the truth, because emotionally, what cancer tries to take a lot from someone,
mm-hmm.
tries to take a lot from someone. And if you're strong enough, which we all try to be, you won't let it take your soul and your spirit. But what the treatment leaves behind is, now you may have someone with who have gained weight from treatment, who might have been thin before treatment and then gained weight, who may have had to have breasts removed. The after treatment medications make your emotions go up and down. One minute you're crying, one minute you're laughing, and it might be really hard for the. First, I want to give a shout out, if I may interrupt for one
mm-hmm.
minute. And not forget the caretakers. God bless
mm-hmm.
all the caretakers that help one through cancer, because they're just as important and they go through just as much too. But as a cancer patient and a survivor, the aftermath of treatment, emotionally, mentally, and physically, is just as hard as the actual treatment. And I'm asking all those who are caretakers and family members of people going through this, just have a little patience and understand that if someone asks you, do you still love me? Am I still pretty? Do I look
mm-hmm.
okay? Or seems to repeat themselves with the same things over and over again, try to understand a little bit more that they just need a little reassurance from the world around them, from the people that they love, that they're still the same person and they're okay. That I find is the hardest thing.
You know, and that's something that we need to be reminded of, because there's that sense of relief of, okay, our loved one is in remission. Yay, we made it. We're at the finish line. But we totally forget, like, the battle scars that obviously will remain. And for me, because our Sarah passed, and unfortunately the two times that I've had to deal with a loved one with breast cancer, sadly the outcomes weren't good. My mother-in-law passed in 2000 from breast cancer that wound up spreading to her bones, and then of course Sarah. In my mother-in-law's case, as devastating as it was for me, because my mother-in-law was more of a mother to me, and I for the first time in my life felt that I had a mother in my life, and I only had her for 6 years, but we were very close, so it was very devastating. But the upside of it was that she lived a full life. She was in her 70s, she had traveled the world, she had done anything you could possibly imagine, to the point that she went on a cruise literally a month before she passed away from this devastating illness. Sarah's case, obviously 32 years old, a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, not so much. That's the one that really tears your heart out, because the whys start coming in. But as a person that's related to somebody that goes through cancer, we don't think about that. We're like, oh, well, you're great now. Go ahead. You know, you're fine. Let's go. Let's go. Your hair will grow back and, you know, you'll be fine. The weight will come off. What are some of the other things that you can tell people to help their loved ones heal emotionally? I know you talked about being patient and, you know, just making sure that you're assured, but what are some other ways that we can be there for our loved ones emotionally after everything that they've gone through?
Well, that's for me personally, I, you know, you had mentioned earlier that, you know, I seem to be a very strong person, and I am a very strong woman. But there are times where emotionally I don't always feel so strong. And sometimes I don't let the world see that. I'll walk out my door with a smile. But when I'm with myself sometimes, I think my suggestion would be for me personally, I always like to hear the people that I love say I love you every day.
Mm-hmm.
Because you never know. I always like a reassuring hug or a kiss on the cheek just because. Or a little smiley note. Stick it up in the mirror in the bathroom. You know, in the morning, just a little smiley. Just a little something to make that person smile. And every day it'll get better and better. I believe, and I live by this thought, that life is a gift. It is yours to do with what you choose. It's your gift to reopen every day. And it's the best regifting of all. And every day you can make a memory is amazing. It could be a small memory, like a postie with a smiley face, or a phone call. I don't have much time, but I was thinking of you today. Or a little candy kiss or something. Those are little things, but they go so far. And for me personally,
you know, it's, well, no, it's true, because I know that one of the things that me personally was something that to this day bothers me is that Sarah and I were very close. Somewhere along, for our listeners, to give you a little bit of a background, I knew her since she was 15 years old. She was best friends with my boys, and she'd been in my life since she was 15. So somewhere along the line, when you know someone from that long, I went from where I was like a mother figure to her, and I looked at her as a daughter, or, you know, someone as like a daughter, and then it went to, okay, you're dating my son, and you're wonderful, and I hope you're part of the family. Then she does become part of the family, so now I become the mother-in-law, and we were very lucky we had a good relationship. But somewhere along the line, from the time she had Tony, the youngest, to the diagnosis and everything, we became really good friends, like best friends. We could talk about anything. And one of the things that devastated me was that I was there as a caregiver for the kids. I would be the one helping the kids out because my son was working all day, then rushing home to see the boys and to the hospital to be with Sarah. I didn't get the chance to talk to her or spend as much time as I would have liked to in the end. So I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, those little stolen moments. And even to this day, and I felt that, and I want to emphasize to my listeners, it sounds like this is a really depressing show, but it's really not, because of the fact that I really want you to understand that if what Darlene and I are saying makes you realize how fragile life is, how important it is to go and just make that little bit of an effort to make a difference in anybody's life, to please do it. Because
absolutely.
Because one of the things we did with Sarah was that when I knew, like, you know, one of those where you know but you don't want to know, I knew that she really wasn't going to get better and that it was basically the end of the line for her. So I told everybody to come to Pennsylvania for her birthday. Her birthday was in February, the end of February. And everybody's like, well, do they know we're coming? No, it's a surprise party. So I basically organized a surprise party, had everybody come. And she literally got out of the hospital the day of her birthday, and everybody was at the house waiting for her. At that time, I had been very ill with pneumonia and all this crap, so I hadn't been here as much as I wanted to because I didn't want to get her sick. Darlene, you know how it is. When people are going through chemo, their immune system is horrendous as it is, so anything can get them sick. And in my back of my mind, I didn't want to make her sick, which was pretty foolish now when I think about it because she was so sick already. Anyway, so I didn't. And the last words that Sarah said to me was after that weekend, that birthday weekend, I was sitting on her bed and I was getting ready to go back to Massachusetts with my husband because I was still very sick. I didn't hug her or hang around her as much and I still had all this crap I had to take. Her last words to me were, wow, I really miss you. I really, you know, wish you were here. And I remember the Holiness of saying, I know, I'll be back in 10 days when I'm done with my antibiotics, and, you know, it'll be great, we're going to hang out. And sadly, my coming back was when my son called me and said, you guys need to get here because Sarah's in a coal mine, you know, the end is near. And I'm saying this to you guys, not for you to feel sorry for me, because luckily, because Sarah and I talked so much, she knew how much I loved her. When I got to the hospital, when they had taken her off life support and all of that, there was a reaction to her when I spoke to her and she heard my voice. So we got to talk. There was no unfinished business with us. Guys, don't let that happen with you guys. And the reason I keep repeating this is because I'm not going to lie, it bothers me every day that I didn't get to spend those last few days with her. And that's the fact that I didn't have unfinished business. I told her how much I loved her. You know, we organized this party for her. We made her feel really special every moment of every day. There's still a lot of regrets. It's just human nature. So don't be the one that said you should have done X, Y, and Z, and then for whatever reason you didn't.
Absolutely.
Darlene.
I totally agree.
Yeah. Now, Darlene, I want to ask you, because I know this great story, and I want you to share it. When you got told that you were in remission, there was something that happened with your wigs. Could you share that story? Because I think it's just so amazing.
Something that what? Oh, my wigs?
Yes.
Oh. Through my whole journey, oh, there's a lot of different stories, but I used to go to this gas station that was near my house. And there was this gentleman there, would see me through my transition of having hair, losing hair. And I didn't know him, but my sister would go there for gas too, and she had told him that I had cancer. So whenever I went there, as I got sick and started losing my hair, you know, he'd be like, how are you doing? How are you doing? And I'd be like, I'm good, I'm good, always smiling. And then the day that actually it was the week that I was in remission, I went to the gas station to get gas, and my hair was starting to grow back, and he looked at me and said, oh, you look so good. And I said, thank you. And he says to me, my wife is not doing so good, and she has cancer. I said, oh, I'm so sorry. And he said, could you tell me where we could go to get wigs and get some help? You know, we don't have a lot of money, but I don't know where to go. And it dawned on me that I just so happened, because I wanted to donate my wigs and I just didn't know where I was going to bring them, it just so happened that I had them tucked away in a nice box in my trunk. And I said, wait a minute. And I got out of my car, and I didn't know him at all, only from pumping my gas. I got out of my car and in my took the box and handed it to him. And he said, oh, my God, bless you. And he started to cry. And I drove away, and I thought, wow, pay it forward. It made me feel so good. I gave something to someone that I didn't even know that was in need and had to go through the same thing that I went through. So it felt really good.
You know, and that's the thing. We as humans can just touch people in so many ways and something so small, because some of us would be like, all right, I don't need those wigs anymore. I'm going to throw them out, or they're going to be collecting dust in the corner. And for you to instantly think about the fact that, wow, here's someone else that is in need, and to pay it forward. Now, I want to touch a little bit on that same tone of your giving spirit. For our listeners, one of the things that our Queen Ambassador got surprised with was that we have a sponsor, Surefire Studios, Surefire Music, Brendan Brady and Jared Hancock, and they are out of Lowell, Massachusetts. Now, this music studio is not a rinky-dinky studio. They've been Grammy-nominated. They've done stuff for some major artists, and they know, they're friends with two of my sons, well, actually all of them, through their music, because my kids used to do music back in the day. So one of the things we decided was that, hey, wouldn't it be great if this amazing singer, Darlene, could actually get into a studio and record a song? So, Darlene, tell our listeners a little bit about what you decided to do with that opportunity to record a song.
Absolutely. It has been my lifelong dream to go into a professional recording studio. And the Sarah Joy Foundation made that dream come true. And the Shofar Studio said, this is big time. We will record it, and we will do your album cover, and we will do the press release, everything. And I said, but I'm not a writer. And they started laughing. Don't worry, we'll help you. Well, I ended up coming up with an original song, and they helped me piece it together. And as I was doing it, I realized what I wanted to do, because this is going to be a hit single. So I decided, because of the Sarah Joy Foundation helping one of my dreams come true, I want to give back. It's my way of saying thank you. So the proceeds to the song, which is titled Stand Strong, will be going to the Sarah Joy Foundation, because I feel as if my dream has already come true. I experienced it with the help of an amazing team. I was able to come up with an amazing song, and it will be on the radio. Someday I'll turn on the radio, and there I'm going to be. That's my pay. But to be able to help the Sarah Joy Foundation is my way of saying thank you, because the foundation means so much to me, and it's my way of giving back. So a portion of the proceeds are going back to the Sarah Joy Foundation.
You know, and for us to be in a situation where that's what happened, it just blew our mind, because that wasn't anything at all what we expected. For our listeners, Darlene actually auditioned for, which show was it that you had auditioned for, Darlene, shortly before you got diagnosed?
I auditioned for before I got diagnosed, I auditioned for America's Got Talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get chosen for America's Got Talent. I had to sign release forms. I had to do the whole thing. I got chosen to go back on the show. And then, unfortunately, I was diagnosed with cancer. I'm like, what the? So I was diagnosed with cancer. However, when I started to feel better and go into remission, I auditioned for The Voice. Now, I received a call back last season for The Voice. So I'm like, oh, my goodness. But I didn't get another call back, and I was so upset, and everybody that knew me was just as upset, because they knew I wanted it so much. But it dawned on me, there's a reason I didn't get that second call back, because you, as a representative of the Sarah Joy Foundation, contacted me to be the Queen Ambassador, and it means to me my voice is needed in much more important areas than The Voice. I'm using my voice in other ways. So thank you for that.
Oh my gosh, the honor is ours, because when we met you, and this is funny, because here we are, we're making a decision, and then a lot of people are like, I have met so many amazing, I'm talking about met people on Facebook where I meet them, and then they wind up, I meet them on Facebook, and then I wind up, hold on one quick sec. I have a question coming in. So what winds up happening is that I've met these amazing people on Facebook, and we network. And I'm very lucky. I don't attract the typical nut jobs that everybody talks about on Facebook. I attract really cool people like Darlene. And it's funny that I've been lucky that a lot of these people later on, I wind up meeting them in a professional setting, Darlene, you being one of them. And it just blows my mind, you know, like they're so cool and all these cool things. So you have to understand that for us to meet Darlene and find out what an amazing person she was. And it was like just like a fit, like just this amazing fit for us, because and I've said this to Darlene a couple of times. She reminds us so much of Sarah a lot of the times, like some of the stuff she says and the way she giggles and just her zest for living. So it's kind of like, whoa. Kind of like Sarah herself was like, yep, this is the person, this is her, you got to pick her. And I remember one time having a conversation with Sarah when I was telling her some of the stuff that you had posted. She's like, oh my goodness, I think I would like this woman. She sounds awesome. Sarah's favorite word was fabulous. She sounds fabulous. I would love to meet her. So it's kind of like she's kind of meeting you from the beyond, and it's like, you know, her hand is there.
Absolutely.
You along the way.
Absolutely. I know you will understand what I'm saying. I hope the listeners will understand what I'm going to say. I feel Sarah's presence around me all the time, especially when I'm representing her, and especially when I say her name. I can feel her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like we are the same. We are one and the same. What she couldn't finish here, she left for me to do, and she's overseeing it.
And, you know, it's funny, too, because I remember, as a loved one, you don't want to discuss, you know, what happens if someone dies kind of thing. It's like you don't talk about it. And one of the things that we would question is, why is this happening to Sarah? Like, Sarah's like the nicest person in the world. She's very giving. She's very kind. And I remember her saying to me, not telling me that she was going to die, but she said, I'm going through this for a reason. She's like, I know without a doubt that something really big and wonderful and important and fabulous is going to come out of this. She's like, we're going to change our family and our life and everything because of everything that I'm going through right now. So I guess that's kind of the lingering thing for us, that every time we kind of want to just give up. And for those of you that have ever run an event, especially a road race, it's something that it's a first time out of the gate. I've done a lot of events, but still, because it's emotionally connected, it's difficult because it's emotional for me. It's not like I'm planning, you know, a luncheon for the mayor where I used to work as a community organizer. It's detached. It's just work. For me, every time I'm organizing, like ordering T-shirts and the medals and getting stuff ready, there's always that, oh, there's Sarah's picture, and start remembering when we used to go for walks or, you know, different stuff that we had done in the past together, and it's very emotional. But her voice is always in the back of my head, like, okay, something good's going to come out of it. So, Darlene, I have to tell you, I'm so grateful that we were able to find you. And that's why life is funny. People talk negatively about the internet and the stuff that's out there. But people, guys, life will give you what you're looking for. If you're looking for negative stuff and drama and all that, that's exactly what you're going to get. But if you're looking for good people and surrounding yourself with the Darlenes of the world, that's what you're going to get. And I really felt that you were drawn to us.
Thank
Darlene,
you so
is there
much.
Anybody
I feel the
that,
same way.
Oh, absolutely. Now, Darlene, is there anybody that you'd like to, hey, give a shout out to or thanks for being there for you all this time?
Well, I'd like to say thank you to my family and my friends. Say hello to my grandson, Kyle, and my children, Angie and Jeremiah, who have been amazing. Dave, I love you. and all the listeners that have tuned in tonight, thank you so very much. And if I might add, I also am working and have been working on a children's book called The Magical Stickers. It's a journey about a little boy named Kyle and his Grammy and how together, through stickers and laughter, they realized that their journey together would be okay. I'm working to try to get a publisher to help me do illustrations. It is not just a children's book about cancer, but it is a learning tool for people who don't know quite how to incorporate children into someone going through cancer. If I may, when I was diagnosed with cancer, I spent a lot of time with my grandson, and I was unable to because I didn't want to scare him. So I talked to him on the phone a lot, and then one day I said, my daughter talked to him and his teachers. So he kind of had an idea of Grammy being sick. But I showed up at his house one day with a scarf on my head, and he was taken back a little bit because it was the first time that he ever saw me with no hair since I got sick.
Mm-hmm.
Before I did, I went to the store and bought 500 stickers. And I sat my grandson down, and I said, you know Grammy's been sick? And he said, yes. And I said, would you like to help Grammy get better? And he said, yes. And I said, if you take these stickers and you put them all over Grammy's head, everywhere you put these stickers with your touch and your love, Grammy's hair is going to grow back. Do you want
Oh, my God, that's amazing.
So we sat down on the floor, and at first he was scared. First couple of stickers, he was really scared. But after a while, we started laughing and we started giggling. And before you knew it, it didn't even dawn on him that Grammy didn't have hair. And I sat on the living room floor with 500 stickers on my head for the rest of the day playing toys. I wrote a story about that. And the proceeds are also going to go to the Sarah Joy Foundation when it's done.
You know, that just is a testament to the kind of person you are. And for our listeners, look, when you do are confronted with an illness, and we kind of can relate, Darlene, because I'm the baby, not so much, because Tony was literally a baby when Sarah got diagnosed. I'm talking like 2 or 3 months. But Eric was older. He was 2.5, and people are like, well, he's 2.5. He doesn't know what's going on. That's not true.
Yes, they do.
They understand. And if you don't address that, that's when there's an issue. And I remember Sarah was so honest with him about it. Like, she didn't want him to be afraid of her being bald. So he knew about mommy's hair and that kind of thing. And the funniest thing is I remember we had gotten him these window paints so he could paint on the window because he loves to paint. And I see him making these dots with circles. And I'm like, Eric, what are you making? What are those? Because I thought maybe they were like stars or flowers or whatever. I mean, we're talking about a 2.5-year-old. He says, JJ, because he calls me JJ. He's like, JJ, I'm making mommy new boobies. Because she needs new boobies.
That's awesome.
So, needless to say, you had to pick me up off the floor because I thought it was
What would Sarah say? Fabulous.
Oh, my gosh. She'd
That's
be like,
fabulous.
Fabulous. Go ahead. Make mommy some new boobies. So it was so funny. And Sarah, you know, you got her personality down pat that she was like, Tiki, you need to make mommy's boobies a little bigger.
It's so funny you said that. People said to me, you know, at first it was hard for me to look in the mirror at first.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm starting to, it is who I am. And I'm not saying I might not get them fixed. Maybe I might want a little bigger size, but
yay.
At first it was hard. Yeah, at first it was hard for me. And I go up to Maine a lot, and my boyfriend, Dave, I'm going to say domestic partner. I feel I'm too old to say boyfriend, so it's my domestic partner. We were up in Maine at camp, and I, you know, had a shirt on that I didn't realize was kind of unbuttoned. And I'm like, he's like, honey, you're showing the ladies. And I'm like, oh, geez, I didn't realize it. So I buttoned my shirt, and a few minutes later, he's got such a funny personality. A few minutes later, he goes, or should I say mother daughter? I started laughing like you wouldn't believe. I thought that was the funniest thing. And I'm just like, I thought, I mean, that's exactly what I did for a long time.
Oh, my goodness.
It was
that's
the funniest
riot.
Thing. So I'm learning, like I said, laughter is good for the soul. Music is good for the soul.
Absolutely.
And if I can find humor in myself, I thought that was the funniest thing. I loved it. So,
oh, man, it's amazing. Darlene, I have to tell you, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. We're definitely going to have you back because for our listeners,
thank you so
this
much.
Woman has stories for days. I mean, she will have you rolling on the floor laughing. So our listeners,
when my song
want,
is released, you'll have to come. You'll have to have me
absolutely.
Back on.
Absolutely. We're going to have an amazing treat for our listeners when Darlene's song drops, as it's called in the industry, because we're just going to have to debut it on our show. If you want to get a hold of Darlene, www.facebook.com/DarleneLouf, L-O-U-F, 2012. That is her Facebook fan page. You can look her up, fan her, and she will be keeping you updated on where she will be. Her next appearance for the foundation, September 15th, she will be in Media, PA, at the 5K, Sarah Joy Foundation 5K. You can get information for the road race also on her page or www.sarahsjoyfoundation.org. She will be giving out medals to the winners there and offering some support as well as hanging out afterwards at the family day. Darlene, thank you so much for being a part of our show and thank you so much for being
pleasure.
Part of the Sarah Joy Foundation family. I'm
my
so grateful
pleasure.
That
thank
you were
you
there.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
And well, have a good night. Thank you so much. And have, oh, you too, hon. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
That was Darlene Luce, the Queen Ambassador for the Sarah Joy Foundation. And we will be having Julie Kinchuk coming up in a few seconds. Earlier in the broadcast, you heard her song Grace, which I happen to love. I have to start with that. But before we go to Julie, we are going to take a little music break right here. Let us get the kinks out. This song is so funny. It's called Get Up Off Your Seat by Ahura Z. DeLisa. He will be one of our guests on the show next week. He will be talking about the book that he just wrote, The Way of the Unicorn. So this is Get Up Off Your Seat by Ahura Z. DeLisa. Talent of Julie Kinchuk.
Oh, am I there?
Miss Ju, yes, you are. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you tonight?
I'm very good, thank you. It's been forever since we've had you on the show.
Well, actually, you know, I think we've been trying to make it happen forever. That's where I'm at. But it's wonderful. It's finally happening.
You know, I'm so excited. It's funny because I was really wanting to have you on the show because for our listeners that have been with us, the show started in September of 2009. So we're going up on our four-year anniversary. So one of the things that I like to do around the anniversary date is kind of get some of the old guests that we had at the beginning that were willing to take a chance on us and be like, what? You want me to be on what? What kind of show? And Julie, you were one of them, and I can't tell you how excited I was. Julie and I did an interview for Citywide Blackout with Max Bowen, another amazing talent, and I just was in awe of your voice. So, Julie, for some of our newer listeners, can you give us a little background or how long have you been singing? How did you decide what style and that kind of thing?
Okay, well, I like to make the joke that I came out of the womb and the doctor slapped my tush and I went, whoa! I've been singing as long as I can remember. But I started playing guitar when I was 9 years old, and that became a vehicle which I could sort of make some sense of the songs I was making up. And I started singing my own songs for people at, you know, school events and local talent shows and church and stuff when I was, you know, about 10. And continued doing it all up through school and I joined a little folk group called Rye Bread my last year of high school, and we played, you know, local venues in around Ithaca, New York, where I grew up at Cornell University and stuff. And I took off to be an exchange student in Europe, and I played the streets all over Europe doing the guitar girl thing. And
that
right
is
after
so
that,
amazing. I mean, I think that that in itself is such an amazing thing. I can't sing to save my life. I can, I hide in choir, you know what I mean? I could, if I have someone that really knows what they're doing, and that's what I usually do, because I have this weird kind of, they call me a tenor, you know, the female tenor, because I have such a deep voice. So I always wind up standing next to, like, a really good singer that's a dude, a guy, and I will pitch off.
Oh, yeah?
That is the only thing I can do. So when I hear someone with your talent, and then the fact that you had the courage to use it. Now, how exciting was it to be all over Europe? And I know for some of us that didn't do it, it sounds exciting, and I know there's obviously the horror stories where, oh, my gosh, do I have enough money? Where am I staying? That kind of thing. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to do that?
Sure. Well, I mean, I was only 18, okay, so I was young and reckless. But
still, that's awesome.
You know, actually, I had, you know, my flight and everything all mapped out, and then I got to LaGuardia, and I forget even why, but I got bumped off my plane, and
mm-hmm.
I could have stayed in New York another couple of days or something to go to Luxembourg, which is what my plan was, but I was like, no, I am ready to go now. And so I just got on the next flight to Amsterdam, and my mother recalls it as like, I can't believe it. She's getting on a plane. We don't know where she's going other than Amsterdam, you know, because, and then I mapped out my itinerary on my way. And so I was a pretty bold kid.
That's awesome.
But I did some stupid stuff. I mean, I ended up in places I would never want my daughter. I now have a 9-year-old daughter. It's like, please, Lord, don't let her be like me. It was exciting, though. I mean, I had my backpack and my guitar, and I did a lot of youth hostels and trains and things at the beginning, and made my way across sort of northern, well, not totally northern Europe, but northern central Europe, like across France and over into Germany, and went to Berlin. And I actually had lived in Berlin for a year when I was 6. My dad was over there on a sabbatic from Cornell University doing a study. And so we had some family friends in Berlin, so I ended up staying with them and got
mm-hmm.
to play in the pedestrian zone. But after, I did then go down to Munich, and I was an exchange student there, so I had a home base, and that helped a lot. But then I would, on all the, like, school vacations and stuff, I would take off somewhere. Like, I spent a week in Florence and Italy, and a week in Vienna, Austria. And then at the end of the year, my boyfriend from the United States flew over, and he was also a guitar player, songwriter, and he and I traveled around thumbing. And I used to sort of compare the way audiences dealt with us in different countries, because
mm-hmm.
we made about the same amount. You know, we supported our, you know, our travel and everything by, you know, just opening our case and playing in pedestrian zones. But, you know, it was very different in different countries. I mean, even though we made about the same money, like in England, you know, we played Covent Gardens, and they would, like, very politely clap, you know. I wish you could see me. I'm doing it with, you know, with sort of a Doctor Who kind of air, right? But when we were in Italy, I remember, and especially when I was in Italy alone, when I was there in Florence before my boyfriend came over, you know, I'd get a mob around me, and, like, some policeman or somebody would decide I was playing somewhere where I shouldn't, and they would try to break through to get me to stop, and the mob wouldn't let them. It's like,
oh, my gosh.
Get back now, you know. But, of course, that went along
like,
with a lot
now.
Of the,
She's just getting warmed up.
I got a lot of attention being a short little blonde American girl in Europe, too, so it was exciting.
Well, the hotness factor, I'm sure, helped a lot, too.
Yeah. But
you got to go all over Europe, and then you came back to the States, and, you know, how did you continue with your music career from there?
Well, you know, I had this plan all set up, right? You know, I was going to go to Europe, but I was going to come back, and I was going to go to Oberlin College and get myself some liberal arts degree in something, right? But
mm-hmm.
Oberlin was, I have to backstep a little bit. While I was in Europe, I got in touch with this producer through a friend that I met in Germany, Richard Gillinson, who was an ex-producer previous producer for ABBA. And Richard the Lionhound, and he was considering doing some kind of rock and roll deal with me, so I almost stayed in London. But then I didn't because he couldn't say anything for sure. So I ended up going back to the States and going, gee, should I stay in London? I don't know if I did the right thing. So then I go to Oberlin, and Oberlin is a very classical school, very classical conservatory with a very sort of left-wing social dynamic going on. And, you know, and I was this sort of folky chick, and I'd never had any classical training. And, you know, I took all of those intro classes and everything, but I was just not cut out to be an opera singer at the time, and didn't really feel like I was accepted musically in that realm. But they had 1.5 jazz professors, and I was listening to a lot of jazz music around
them. 1.5.
Well, it was one guy who's part time, right? And so I ended up learning how to scat sing because I would take these jazz labs, and nobody else there could scat sing, so I learned from saxophone players. And so I would imitate saxophones and trumpets and stuff, and I put together my own jazz group while I was there. And, you know, I thought, this is so awesome. And the tenor in the group, he said, you know, you really ought to check out Berklee College of Music in Boston because, you know, you love it. And I did. I came here for a summer, and I did love it. And I ended up, after another semester back in Oberlin, you know, I learned a lot of intro to everything in Oberlin. But then I came back to Berklee on a full scholarship and stayed and graduated here in Boston, and here I still am.
That's amazing. I mean, what a you know, circumference to go all around full circle. Before we go on, I want to share one of your songs. This actually is one of my favorite, which is funny because I've had it on our queue since back in the day when you were on our show back in the beginning. This is called The Coffee Song. So I'm going to play it, and then I'm going to ask you a little bit about it because I really do love this song, and I love the vibe of it. So for our listeners, this is The Coffee Song by Julie Kinchek. that was the Coffee Song by Julie Kinchek. And I have to say, I just absolutely love that song. Julie, tell me a little bit about the background, because I know the background story behind it, and that's why I think it's such an amazing song. You want to tell our listeners where that concept came from?
Sure. Well, I was dating my husband. Okay, let me back that up. Nope, I wasn't dating him. We were not even dating yet. My husband and I actually knew each other at Berklee College of Music, but we were not friends. And then 8 years later, we met again through a church we both became part of, and we were hanging around together. And you know that time in a relationship when there's some sparks flying, but nobody's, like, admitted it yet, you know? And
Oh, yeah.
I kind of thought he liked me, and he kind of thought I liked him, and but neither of us had really, you know, put voice to it. So I finally decided, okay, there's something really going on here. And so I wrote this song, and I gave it to him on a cassette tape, and we hadn't even sort of acknowledged to each other that we were interested yet. So you got to see that he was probably a little freaked out, but I guess it worked, because we just had our 18th anniversary last week, so.
Well, congratulations. That's awesome. So, Julie, do you write most of your own songs?
Well, I mean, the ones I record, I do. I mean, I've written hundreds of songs, maybe thousands, I don't know. Not thousands that I play for someone else, but I play a lot of covers, too. You know, it depends where I'm playing and what I'm doing. I mean, I play jazz gigs. I played in country bands and wedding bands, and I play funerals, and I played in rock bands, and I do a lot of church stuff too. But you know, my favorite thing to do is to write songs, because I feel like writing songs I'm really grateful for the gift, because it does good for me, and then if it comes out well, it does good for others, because
mm-hmm.
it's really the way to put what I'm feeling and what's on my heart out there in an artistic form. And I've always kind of felt like I was supposed to do something important with my music, whether support things that I believe in, encourage people, bring them hope, change the world some way with my art.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly, you know, there's been times along the way when I've been frustrated and said, well, you know, am I really doing what it is that I'm supposed to be doing? I don't feel like I've made the progress or whatever. But I think I finally come to a place kind of recently, actually, where I just feel like, okay, God has put this on my heart, and I will do it because I love to do it, and I pray to find that audience of people that love
mm-hmm.
what I'm doing, because I'm going to keep putting it out there.
You know, it's kind of like that. Yeah, no, it's true, because that's one of the things I've noticed with a lot of creative people is there's that frustration of getting it out there. And it's funny, because the only thing I can think of, and actually it was my husband, he's the smart one in the family, that said to me, you know what, babe, he's like, if you build it, they'll come, just like Field of Dreams. It's kind of that when the time is right, whatever it is that you're meant to do with your gift will materialize. And on that note, I really want to play this song, because we're running short on time, but I really want the listeners to hear this, and then you can tell us a little bit about where this, you know, whole concept. So for our listeners, this song is called Precious, and it's by Julie Kinchek.
Diamonds, rubies, and sapphires, and pearls.
And that was Precious by Julie Kinchuk. Now, Julie, where did the inspiration for that come from? Hello,
say,
Julie.
Yes, hello.
I lost you there for a minute.
Every once in a while, I hear like this man's voice coming in. I don't know what that is. but anyway. Can't be on my cell phone. Go figure that one. All right. I just wanted to say that that a lot of the music that I write is really, really meant for women. Not that men can't enjoy what I do. They like to hear the staff singing or whatever. But I'm a woman and I'm a mom and I've been through stuff. And you know, we've all been through stuff. You know, and I heard your last interview and there's some serious stuff going on there. And,
oh yeah.
You know, and I was so hysterical at the end. But getting back to Precious, I was infertile, and I couldn't have children. And I had really bad endometriosis, and, you know, I had all kinds of scar tissue all over my ovaries and uterus and stuff. And I had surgery, and they said it should all work, and it still didn't work. And if there's any women out there who've gone through this, it's so painful.
Mm-hmm.
Not just physically painful. I mean, yeah, okay, some surgeries, this different stuff. But, you know, emotionally it's so hard. And after 8 years, as the song says, of prayers and tears, finally after the second round of in vitro, I was pregnant with twins. And I was so amazed that I could love them so much. And I didn't even know them yet. I mean, I wrote this song and they were in my tummy. You know, Hannah and Caleb are 9 now. But, you know, I had twins at 40. Uh-oh, I'm giving it away.
You are courageous, my woman.
crazy. You know, and I realized at that time that, you know, God's timing is perfect, even though I desperately wanted children before that time, my husband has had a lot of health issues. And actually, if we had had kids around the time I first wanted them, he wouldn't have been able to be very involved in their childhood because he was so sick. And I would have been trying to care for babies and sick husband at the same time and be the main breadwinner. But by the time I had the children, my husband was doing better. He was able to go back to work full time. And I was able to stay home with the kids and you know, just work on my music and build I teach voice and guitar lessons out of my home in addition to playing. And I was able to build that up, you know, because my husband was healthier by then. And I know that's God's perfect timing. And
it's true.
Yeah.
It's very true. And that's something that it's evident in your music. And I guess that's one of the reasons why I'm more drawn to singers that do their own music, like write their own songs, because it's like you can kind of tell all this personal stuff on a good level that was going on and they wrote this song. And that song, Precious, I just love it because it's just, one of those that definitely tucks at the heartstrings. And not just for women, men too. If you have a child, you know right away, we know who you were writing this about or that kind of thing. But Julie, it was so nice to have you. And every time you're on the show, we run out of time so quickly. Next time I'm going to have to have just a huge segment just for you.
I just say something before I go? And that's that I got a new CD.
Absolutely.
And I know we've been saying it's coming out for a while, but it really is coming out. in the next month or so, it's really going to be done. And we're really excited about it. It's a real collaboration. My husband and I co-wrote most of the songs together. And
awesome.
You know, it's got the influence of his. He's got sort of a progressive rock keyboard background, so he's got this sort of 80s thing going on. And, you know, it still has my sort of jazzy, heartfelt lyric thing going on. So it's an interesting, combination. And it definitely is coming from, you know, a Christian point of view, you know, worldview, but the stuff is not all necessarily in your face, so to speak. It's just coming from that place. And if you want to know more about it, those of you out there, you always go to JulieKSings.com.
And for our listeners, for our listeners, I put the website name up in the chat room, and I will also, and it's also up on the segment information. That's www.JulieKSings.com. So we can get information on when the CD drops and what you're up to and that kind of thing.
Yep, and I got a Facebook fan page. You can either look up Julie Kinchek, sounds like Kim's check, if you're trying to spell it, or Facebook.com/ Queen of Scat is the other way to find it. But,
right, and for our listeners, all that information is also on the segment page, so you can look Julie up and definitely want to share more of her music. Julie, thank you so much for being with us. I so enjoy every time we have you.
Oh, thank you. I'm so sorry I couldn't be here longer. But, thank you, everyone out there listening. And I just want to send a shout-out to my husband, Ralph. Love you so much.
And we definitely hope that as soon as that CD drops, we'll get to have you back on.
Definitely. Thank you so much. All right.
You're welcome. Have a
nice
great
day.
Night. Bye-bye.
Bye.
She is so amazing. I just love her music. So on that note, we want to move to our next guest because we're running a little behind, and I do want to get him in because I cannot wait to ask him. Our next guest is Tim Ryan. He's an actor and a film director. Tim, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes. Thank you so much for being on the show. I'm so excited to have you.
Well, thank you for having me. This is pretty cool.
Tim, I'm going to get right to it because we just so short on time, and I want to get in as much as we can in the next 20 minutes, and I'm definitely going to have you back on. Tim, where did you come up with the concept of date night?
Watching Dateline, you know, Chris Hansen. My old roommate and I would catch an episode, and like they'd have a marathon on MSNBC, and before you know it, we're watching hours of it. Because it's like watching a car wreck, really, when you watch it. And I always thought, what do these guys do before they walk into the house, and how come nobody notices their behavior, you know? Or aren't there clues to give it away that, you know, it shouldn't come down to them walking into a house? And that's pretty much how it gestated, I guess.
Well, it was funny, too, because I talked to Adam Dawes, who we had on the show a couple of weeks back, and he's actually the main actor in it, you know. And if you guys haven't seen it, you definitely got to check it out because it's really cool. So I remember asking, like, do I really want to play this character? So when it was finished, he sent me a link to it, and one of the things that I loved about it was, Tim, you made me have all these emotions about the main character in, like, what? How long is it, 7 minutes, not even?
Yep. And it was more of an experiment. I direct one-act shows at Freeport High School in Freeport, Maine, and pretty much our film team is myself and my drama students are the tech crew, and we bring in adult actors, and we make, I won't say an adult movie, that's the wrong term, but, you know, a movie for an older crowd versus a high school crowd. And we like to experiment every year, and this year we decided, well, let's make the audience feel icky and build a character up and tear him down and make the audience feel guilty for liking him.
Oh my gosh, are you kidding me? That's exactly the whole range of emotions that I went through, because, and you definitely picked the right actor, because Adam, I think, was, I mean, obviously I have no idea who else you would have picked, but Adam just embodies that, where you're like, oh, look at this guy, he's so cool, and, you know, he's so lucky, and yay, he finally found it. And you're like, wait a minute, really? No, hey, back it up. No, I don't like you anymore. But then again, you bring me back to, at the end, not to give it out for you people that haven't seen it, and I'm like, oh, but wait, I kind of still feel bad, even though I shouldn't, in a weird kind of way.
and I guess in real life, that's way. And we also wanted to put people in a pedophile's shoes. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and as best as we can, without, you know, being too graphic. And that was another thing, was holding back and finding the right tone and not being offensive or making fun of the subject, you know.
But that was another thing that I think really hit it on the head, where it was just so subtle that it was creepy subtle. You know what I'm saying? It was so well done that it's kind of like, wow.
Yeah,
you really relayed the point that these people look normal sometimes, and then all of a sudden you're like, whoa, wait, kind of thing.
And if it's like The Sixth Sense, if you go back after you find the big reveal and go back and rewatch it, the clues were all there in every scene. There's something there.
Oh, my goodness.
That shows that it's that he's off. You know, everything from drinking out of the Thomas the Tank Engine cup to little remarks he makes when other people talk to him. And, you know, it was an experiment just to see if we could do it, because you don't see it that often in films.
Right.
You know.
And that was the whole thing that it really threw you off, because, like I said, I'll put the link up for our listeners, because you're watching this, and me personally, I know that it's going to be a 6-7 minute thing, because it's a short, it's for the 48 film, you know, the 48-hour film festival, and there's, you know, certain requirements that need to happen, so obviously you got to get to it quick. But the way you were able to set up the scene, set up the whole concept of it, make me fall in love with this character in a matter of 45 seconds. And then the big letdown, and you're like, you, if I ever find you, but maybe I'll still bring you a cookie, or do you need bail money? You know, it's like, that was the genius behind it.
Well, if you look on YouTube, too, a lot of people loved it, and there were people that hated it. I've gotten hate email, actually, just because, I guess, you know. And I told somebody, the person said, I felt very uncomfortable watching this, and I said, well, that was the purpose of it.
Duh.
And they go,
hello.
And then they're pretty much go, no, it wasn't. And I go, yeah, it was. I was in a room full of 30 people when we decided, let's make the audience feel icky, you know, and that's what we set out to do.
And not only that, it's kind of funny because you're the creative genius. You're the one that, you know, birthed it. And they're like, no, that's not what you meant to do. You know, like when people say to you, is that really your kid? Well, gee, I was in the hospital room at the time he popped out. I'm pretty sure that's him. Now, also to touch a little bit on, you're not only just a director and a writer, but you're also an actor yourself.
Yeah, and I'm in the movie. I'm in the very last scene. And I was blessed to win Best Supporting Actor for my 20 seconds on film for that, which is cool.
That's why I wanted to bring that up. Now, what part did you play? And again, it goes back to this part. Like, sometimes, you know, it's funny. Awards are won by actors. You don't have to be there the whole time. You will have these actors that will come in literally for a split second and just totally steal the scene. And people will be talking about it. So tell us a little bit about what you played and what part it played in the short film.
The very, very last scene, we weren't sure how to end it. We wanted, because Adam's a defeated man at the end. And, you know, he's in custody and all that. But I, as a director and writer, I wanted to show that Adam, you feel kind of bad, like you said, despite doing this horrific thing, but I wanted to show this guy was really dangerous. So I wanted to, we figured we'll end it by sitting him next to a really crazy person who got apprehended in the same sting. And I play this very crazy pedophile, crazy person. And, and I'm pretty bloodied up, like I took on the entire police force. And I say a few things, and people, the judges dug it. So, and I'm honored. You know, I don't know what to say. I'm still shocked because, yeah, it's like a 20-second appearance. More of a cameo.
It is,
like.
And it's very, no, and it's very powerful, because some of my listeners know this, so the new ones know. I was a police officer for 20 years, a state trooper. I actually was trained as a rape investigator, child abuse investigator, the whole thing. And it was pretty funny because Adam sent me the link. He's like, oh, I'll send you the link when it's done. So I wind up watching this by myself, like at 1:30 in the morning, you know, typical lights out, just the computer on. And there was this overwhelming feeling like, I really need to get up and take a shower right now, because I was like, ew, what the hell did I just watch? And it was funny because, see, and that's where I love the creative the creative path that you took, because less is so much more in certain genres. And that's what I loved about it, because there was a lot of hinting at the beginning, and there was a lot of clues, and you didn't have to be all out, you know, ridiculously where it would have been, you know, something so much controversial, but it was just enough because you left it to my imagination. And again, when you've been a cop for 20 years, my imagination can go into some really dark places.
Yeah. And imagination's more powerful than anything any filmmaker can make, and it's cheaper, too, when you're a filmmaker.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
And as we all know, it's better because a perfect example, the short series It by Stephen King, nothing ticked me off the most than when they showed me the thing at the end. It's like, don't show me. What was in my mind was so much more horrific than what you just... I am actually angry right now. Because that's not it. And, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, you turn the light on and the boogeyman was just my neighbor's ugly cat. So, now, as an actor, give me a little bit about your background. How long have you been in the industry?
Over 18 years. I didn't get into it till I was an adult. I wanted to do it in school. Nobody encouraged me. And I saw an ad on TV for Dracula. A local community theater was producing it. And I go, well, that'd be pretty cool, you know. And I mentioned it to my coworkers. I used to work at a mental hospital, believe it or not. And I mentioned it to my coworkers.
Whoa, that's funny.
And I mentioned that it would be cool to play Renfield, because that was my favorite character from the book. And pretty much, I worked in this department. I was the only guy. There was like nine women I worked with. And they all pretty much browbeat me, or whatever you want to call it, saying, you're not coming back tomorrow until you go there tonight and try out. And I did. I got the part. And the rest, they say, is history. And I acted in stage for almost 10 years. Then I lucked out, and I got a part in HBO film's Empire Falls, and that kicked off my film career, I guess. Paul Newman's last movie, how cool was that?
Oh my gosh, that would have been a dream come true, because I absolutely loved him as an actor and just as a human being in general because of what he stood for. I want to bring something up, because you mentioned something when we were communicating back and forth, and I want our listeners to hear this. You've had quite a successful career. You know, you've worked a lot, you've done a lot, you've mentored a lot. And one of the things you mentioned was that you're still in Maine. You know, you've never left the state. And one of the things you said to me, which it really pumped me up as an actress, is when you said when you love what you do and you're doing it, it just happens. Can you talk a little bit about that? Can you... I really thought it was just so amazing. Could you give us a little bit of how you came to that philosophy and how it's worked for you?
Theater changed my life. And that if you set your mind to something, you can do it. I remember when I did Dracula, the script was pretty bad. As far as it had these, Renfield was saying some really bad one-liners. And I would try to change it, and the director said, you can't because it's copywritten. And this is back when I was a newbie. I just had no clue. I go, well, this joke stinks. Let's put a new joke in. And I kept saying, I can write better stuff than this. And the director said, well, why don't you? So I did. And I actually wrote a play based on Renfield, which never got produced. Someday, maybe. But after finishing that script, I go, yeah, I could do another one. And I wrote Who Pushed Humpty Dumpty, which is a children's whodunit. And I did it for the theater that I...
Wait, back up. You wrote that?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I love that. I I did not know you wrote that.
I did. It's
that
been done all
amazing.
Over the world, too.
Yes, I love that, and I did not realize that that was you. I didn't make the connection. That's amazing.
Oh, and it was recently done in New Zealand. I thought that was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
But basically, I sat down and go, what would be the biggest play ever for a community theater? And I thought a children's whodunit musical, and it was originally going to be a musical, and long story short, I didn't know any musicians, so the music part got dropped. But yeah, so I wrote it.
See,
and,
I love the creative process. It's like, yeah, we were going to do a musical, but no, we didn't know anybody. So next,
yeah, basic. And I was inspired by Who Framed Roger Rabbit, so I threw every non-copywritten storybook character into the show. And yeah,
goodness.
And in fact, the theater group I founded, Freeport Family Performing Arts, will be doing it this year, 2014 in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And setting it up for the sequel, Murder Over the Rainbow, which is...
Oh, my goodness.
That's coming,
I
hopefully...
I cannot wait.
That's coming in 2015 or 16, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
So,
see, it's funny because... You know, it's funny how we're talking to my first guest, Garlene, how you attract certain people into your life. To me, it's funny because I love screenwrites and, you know, and all that. And it just blows my mind that here is a play that I really loved so much. I thought it was so funny and so quirky. And I thought it was just a great novel idea. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, yeah, I wrote that. Wait, what? Really? Back up. Rewind. It's just, I am blown away because I really loved it, and I cannot wait for the sequel kind of thing, the part two.
Oh, I can't either.
But oh, my goodness, it's so amazing.
But basically writing that, then getting it published, just showed me you can do anything you set your mind to it. And I think with anything in life, obstacles that stand in your way are built up through your mind. I mean, when you think of a published playwright, you think of, you know, like Arthur Miller or somebody, and these guys are, like, way above you, and there's no way you can do that, and, you know, and you realize, you know, you can do it, you know, if you just sit down and set your mind to it. And
you know, that is so true, because I know that I, and a lot of us can relate to this, especially in anything that has to do creative, or even in life, we do talk ourselves out of a lot of things with excuses about why we can't do X, Y, and Z. And then, ironically, when we overcome that and actually accomplish it, you sit there on the other end going, oh, that was kind of easy. It wasn't as hard as I thought it was going to be, and it was fun.
And
now, Tim, you have this amazing, just zest for life. So you've been doing this, and how are you able to continue to do what you love on such a level? Because we're not talking about, you know, just background work. You're actually working. You have... award, you know, you're winning awards, you're doing these amazing projects. How are you able to create this in a place where people would be like, Maine, really, kind of thing? How do you think it is that happens?
Well, with theater, I try to do stuff that's different. I mean, how many times can you see Oklahoma? Not to dump
mm-hmm.
on Oklahoma, but some place gets done a lot.
Right.
I try to do stuff that nobody's seen before and people want to see. And like I did a adaptation of American Werewolf in London that that was based on the BBC radio play that was based on the movie. And, you know, that sounded pretty challenging. That's a whole story. That's a whole story in itself, how we got that one off the ground. But, yeah, you got to be diligent when it comes to that stuff. Like most people who were telling me, you'll never get permission to do that. And I go, well, I'll keep going until someone says no. And
right.
I learned that when I directed my second year of Freeport High School, we did an adaptation of Monty Python and the Holy Grail that was sanctioned by Monty Python themselves. And
oh, my goodness.
This was a year and a half before Spamalot, and everyone kept saying,
oh,
no way
wow.
they'll tell, Yeah, and there's no way they'll tell you yes. I mean, and I'm thinking, you know, I just said, well, do it till someone says no, and they didn't. In fact, I dealt with their business manager, and who ran it by John Cleese, I guess, and they were very tickled that high school kids wanted to do their material, and I'm thinking, wow, nobody's really asked them before, and come to find out, we were one of the first stage adaptations ever of it. And,
well, see, that's the thing, because you're talking yourself out of it. You're like, well, it's this big production, these big actors, this big thing. They'll never say yes. And one of the things that I'm beginning to realize, and it's kind of funny, it took me this long, and I've also said this to my kids, but you know how it is. We're so quick to be able to give this amazing advice, but we never take it. You won't know until you ask. And the worst they can say is no, and you're like, all right, whatever, and then move on.
And that's the way.
Something else, and ask someone else.
Yeah. And, like, we were shocked, you know. Oh, my God, Monty Python said yes to us, you know, Freeport, which is a town that's like 5,000 people tops, you know.
Oh,
and this little high school is doing this adaptation, and it looked like we were the first in the U.S. to do it, at least. And after the show was popular, I mean, my God, we had lines wrapped around the high school waiting to get in. And,
of course, I can imagine.
Then after the show was done, apparently the Spamalot producers caught wind of it. And through a friend, there was a mutual friend of the stage manager of Spamalot and one of my students' parents. And in a roundabout way, Spamalot producers contacted us and asked us for everything we had. They wanted to see how we pulled off, like, the Black Knight, the Killer Rabbit, all those, and the Trojan Rabbit with, like, a $500 budget. And, you know, it was kind of like Stone Soup. We had the whole town involved, you know, and everybody donated a lot of things. And we actually had a Trojan Rabbit that was half the scale of the real deal. That was kind of cool.
That's insane. That is insane. So, Tim, I can't believe how fast the time goes by when I have these amazing guests, which is usually all the time. But so, what's up next for you? What projects do you have coming up?
I just got a part in this movie called Catatonic Blues, which stars Treat Williams. It's filming in Maine. Yeah, and I've got it's a one day shoot. I get a one scene with Treat Williams. I get to yell at him, so I'm psyched about that. And it's always cool when they pay you to do it too.
Especially.
Then, of course, I've got the One Acts coming in this winter, and we're Freeport High School's one of only three high schools in the state out of 91 high schools that produce student-written plays, and we've been doing it for over 10 years now. So
that's awesome.
Our goal is to be the first high school to win a state title with a student-written play, which is like a Jackie Robinson-type obstacle. So that's our mission.
Yes. If anybody can pull it off, it's definitely you. For our listeners, you can look Tim up, www.facebook.com, Timmy Time One. Look him up and befriend him. And then there's links on your page, right, to date night on there as well?
Yeah, and everything I got going, I post on there.
Awesome.
My students accuse me of being a media whore.
I love it. You have to be. Hey, no one else is going to promote you but you. You got to do it. So,
that's right.
Tim,
you
it was
open
awesome
your own
having
doors.
You. You have to open. Shoot, jump in that window. That would be me next. You'll see my button.
Make your own damn door.
In.
That's what I tell the kids.
So, Tim, thank you so much for being on the show. Is there anybody you'd like to give a shout out to before you go?
I would love to say hi to my beautiful daughter, Maggie, who's probably in bed right now, but she'll listen to the recording of this online. So I love
you. Awesome. That is so cool. So, Tim, I'm definitely going to have you on in the next few months to know what you're up to, because you are hysterical, and everybody on the chat room is like, this guy's funny. I have to say real quick, one of the chat people says, one time seeing Oklahoma is one time too many. So they agree with you.
try sitting through Little Women the play. I was actually in it when an actress dropped out. I played Hannah, the cleaning woman. That was So.
Oh my goodness, are you serious? That's one play that I had to read for school, and then I kind of liked it, but I can't imagine having to sit through it more than once.
The best line in the show is "fish balls for everybody." That was a big, it made us all laugh backstage.
I'm gonna have to get a T-shirt with that on it. Fish balls for everybody.
That was my line. Fish balls for everybody. I lived to
say
that.
Oh man, that's a riot. Well, Tim, thank you so much for being on the show. We look forward
to
having
you
in the future. Oh, anytime.
All right, cool.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Oh man, I'm telling you, this is one of the reasons why I love doing this show. It's just that every time I get these amazing guests, and it seems like there's no way that can ever get topped off. The next guest is even funnier and more talented, and just, it's just so lucky to be able to do this. And, you know, we really do need to take Tim's advice. The fact is that if you're passionate about something, you can definitely create it. And honestly, for me, because of life circumstance right now, I can't go to New York every day and work as much as I'd love to. But the reality is that I can find other ways to be creative and do the things that I love. So for next week, I want to tell you guys we're going to have the amazingly talented Jay Walker. He is a poet and an actor and someone that I have just been dying to have on the show, and I finally corralled him to have him on. We're also going to have the multifaceted Ahura Z. Deliza. He is a psychic, metaphysics, among other things, but we're actually going to have him on the show discussing his new book, The Way of the Unicorn. He will be on there talking about that. So just to remind you guys, Thoughtful Thursday, every Tuesday, I like to have a thought to leave you with. Remember, your dreams are yours and yours alone. No one can take them away from you. The only one that can forget them is you. So remember, always strive, always fight for what's yours, and remember that as long as you're happy doing it, continue to do it, and it doesn't really matter what anybody else thinks. So from Diamond in the Rough, I want you to have an amazing week. Looking forward to it. Don't forget, Shelley's on tomorrow night from 9 to 11 with her great sense of humor and her wonderful guests as well. So leaving you with this, Picture Perfect by Jenna Donovan. Have a great night, and looking forward to seeing you next week.
Can we get some more makeup on her?
I don't think I need to suck it in.
Okay. Just don't worry about it. We'll Photoshop it out.
But I don't want you to Photoshop it out. This is me.
Different girls, same face. Page after page.